You ever feel like all these talking heads only point out problems and never got a solution? Well, today we're going to be kicking it back old school. I mean, kicking it back to our founding documents, Constitution, and with the help of Peter Serafin, author and constable in the state of Pennsylvania, we are going to dive into some possible remedies to the issues we're looking at as Americans and honestly around the world here in 2024. So I want you to sit around. Really pay attention to this one. Take some notes if you have to. And let's dive back into the history of the United States to prove that there's a way out of this. Truly bona fide, written in text. We just got to follow the letter of the law. Let's go. My first question to you, of course, is Peter, you have quite a storied past. Your new book is, at least I read the excerpt from it. I'm pretty excited to read the whole print of it. But what brings you to writing books at this point in your life? What, take me through it.
Well, it was probably 2014, 2015, something like that. I looked at the world and thought, man, people are going crazy. Society is just nuts. To be honest, the single event that was the straw that broke the camel's back, or the catalyst, or whatever you want to say, was when Virginia and New York both made it legal to have abortions up to the birth of a child. And in the
I
case,
remember that being a big story. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the case of Virginia, Governor Northam at the time, he was a pediatrician before becoming governor. And he said on a radio interview that, you know, in the case of like a botched abortion, when the baby comes out alive, that they would keep the baby comfortable and have a discussion with the parents about what to do. And I'm thinking,
I remember that interview.
You're
that was
a pediatrician, and that's a baby at that point. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you feel about abortion. At that point, it's a baby.
Yep.
And I just thought society was going crazy.
Couldn't
and
agree
I
with
thought,
you
well,
more.
I got to do something. And with all the modern, you know, self-publishing tools that are out there, I was like, anybody can write a book. I'll write a book. So I wrote a book.
Love
What
it.
was your first written book?
The first thing I ever wrote to be published anywhere, like including never wrote a letter to an editor, never submitted a story to a newspaper, nothing like that. The first thing I ever wrote was my first book, Progress. Really? One man's progress of social. One man's view of social progress in America. It's only like 50 pages long.
Okay.
And it's just what it sounds like. It was me looking back during my own lifetime in certain areas to see, you know, the social progress. You know, the example I usually give in conversation is Boy Scouts. You know, when I was a Cub Scout becoming a Boy Scout, right about the time in the probably the 1980s. When there was a big discussion about whether or not to allow openly gay scouts and scoutmasters in the Boy Scouts. And okay, so that was the discussion going on then. And now my own son, well, he went to the World Jamboree, which is a once every 4 year huge Boy Scout event. I never got to go, but my kid went. He went, and there were girls there, and they were handing out condoms at the orientation. And I'm like, that goes against everything the Boy Scouts stands for. Like, the Boy Scouts was supposed to be a Christian-run nonprofit organization that, that taught Christian values to children, and they're handing out condoms at summer camp.
That blows me away.
Yeah, and they
How old are these children, if you don't mind me asking?
He's 19 now.
Okay. All right. At what age were they handing out condoms? I hope it was at least like middle school and Eagle Scout. Like,
yeah, no, he wasn't an Eagle Scout yet.
Okay.
And I'm kind of mixed about the whole allowing girls into the Scouts. I have to be honest here.
I think it's, why would you call it Boy Scouts? Not to go on a tangent, but why would you call it Boy Scouts if there's girls allowed?
Well, that's why they had to drop boy out of the name. And now
it's just called Scouts.
But my daughter, my youngest daughter was one of the first girls to make Eagle Scout because she would go with her twin brother and younger brother to all of the Boy Scouting events because she hated the Girl Scouts and she liked the Boy Scouts. So she went to everything with them. And then when girls were allowed, she was like, well, I've already done all of these things. And she made Eagle Scout pretty quick. Now, the twins, Peter and Abby, they both made Eagle Scout. And, you know, that's a very proud moment for me.
That's pretty amazing.
But still, it's the Boy Scouts, or at least it was. It should be, in my opinion. But I talk about
Traditionally speaking, at least, does the Girl Scouts offer something to girls that the Boy Scouts doesn't offer to boys? Because you mentioned that they didn't like the Girl Scouts. So I'm wondering what exactly that could be.
Well, they were very different. The boys were about, you know, camping and survival skills and, you know, wood chopping and things. Mm. And the girls was much more about homemaking and not a whole lot of camping involved. But there is another program that I think falls under the BSA, the Boy Scouts of America umbrella. There was another program that was open to both boys and girls. And I can't think of the name of it right now, but they were in that too. So, I mean, she had her outlet, but, you know, the point I make in the book is, you know, it started with, hey, should we let gay people be involved? Because again, it's a private organization. They can choose to exclude
piling onto they call that the slippery slope, right?
Exactly. And then they got sued repeatedly for not allowing gays or not allowing trans or not allowing whoever they felt, you know, whatever. They just got sued so many times that they acquiesced and gave in.
Right. Now, so that kind of carries me in. I want to ask about, at least it seems like your first, I don't know if this was your first bigger book, but your book that you wrote, A More Tyrannical King. So that really intrigued me, and I definitely want to read that one because the sentiment behind it is something that I've been feeling very attached to lately, is that our federal government has gone amok. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Each book gets a little bit longer. It's funny. You know, the first one was like, was like 50 pages, and the second one was like, 80. And then the third one was like 120, and the new one is like 200.
Gotcha. Okay.
But A More Tyrannical King, how the federal government has become more oppressive than King George. What made me think about that one, what put the idea into my head was the Boston Tea Party. If you think about it, and the American colonists are so upset over this tea tax and the idea that, you know, the British crown is going to tax them at all, that they take a shipload of tea and dump it all in there. I mean, it took them hours to dump it all into the harbor. And it made me think, they were that upset that they were willing to spark a war with the most powerful country on the planet. What would that tax have cost the 13 original colonies? So I did the math. You know, the Boston tea tax at the time was 3 pence a pound or something like that. So I did
technically a decrease from the original tax. It was just supposed to be implemented.
Yeah, there's a lot of convoluted stuff in there. They went from the Stamp Act and then they went, we'll drop that. We'll just do this one. And it still pissed off the colonies. They're like, no, you can't do it at all. But anyway, the math that I came up with when, you know, converting pence to pounds and pounds to dollars and dollars in 1773 to dollars today, that tax would have cost all 13 colonies total about $300,000 a year. And I'm like, our government wouldn't even bother to listen to you if you asked for $300,000. Like, yeah, here, shut up, sign, go away. $300,000 is nothing to them. I mean, that's literally seconds worth of our federal budget. But back then, it was enough to potentially spark a war.
And so did you dive into just the history of our government slowly taking more and more power up to that highest echelon of the federal?
Kind of. What I did is I tried to look at it in different categories.
Okay.
So you know, chapter one was the expansion of the executive power. So, you know, originally the president didn't have any power. He was right. There to enforce the laws passed by Congress. But at the time, there was only like, you know, a dozen laws that had been passed by Congress. And then the supremacy of the federal government, how federalism versus limited government has kind of created or morphed into the federal Leviathan that we have today. And again, compared to King George. So each one of these chapters, I look at what it was like then, what it's like now, and then I compared the two, King George's government circa 1775 to government today.
I like that a lot. Now, did you see was there a direct jumping off point from the last book into your new book now, Trust Shattered? Or is this completely just its own idea?
There must have been something in writing A More Tyrannical King that sparked Trust Shattered, because no sooner did I hit the publish button and put A More Tyrannical King on the market did I immediately had the idea for Trust Shattered and started writing. I did almost no marketing for A More Tyrannical King. I think I did like, I don't know, 3 podcast interviews or something like that. I've got 20 podcast interviews scheduled for Trust Shattered, and it still doesn't come out for almost 3 months. So A More Tyrannical King, unfortunately for it didn't get a whole lot of my attention once it was written. I immediately dove into writing Trust Shattered.
Okay.
But
tell me a little bit about Trust Shattered. What, what did you use this opportunity for?
Trust Shattered, cases of government betrayal, catalogs about 45 instances where government has betrayed our rights in some way. And I divided the betrayals into 3 categories based off of John Locke's Life, Liberty, and Property. So it's 3 parts to the book. Part 1 is betrayed bodies, government's unauthorized human trials. Part 2 is betrayed liberties. And part 3 is betrayed estates, properties conquest by authority. So these 45 examples, you're probably thinking, only 45? I specifically excluded anything that anybody could call a conspiracy theory. It is 45 things that the government has either admitted to or has been caught red-handed in doing. Like everything, it's a 30,000 foot overview of all 45 examples. It's a 30,000 foot overview because they're all well known enough that if you don't know about it, Google it. You'll find all you want to know. It's not a deep dive. It doesn't take a ton of research. Right. And it's things, the second chapter in Betrayed Bodies is the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. Everybody knows about the Tuskegee experiments, right?
Right.
Well, they should.
Not everybody knows exactly what went on there. They know about it.
Right. And if you talk to some people, okay, so the official story is that these government doctors found 600 men in Tuskegee, Alabama, 600 black men in Tuskegee, Alabama that had syphilis, and then just studied them for 40 years without treating the syphilis, even though like maybe 5 or 10 years after they started the study, it became common knowledge that syphilis was curable with penicillin.
Penicillin, yeah.
But they kept studying for decades more without treating any of them. Some people out there think that the government gave those 600 men syphilis.
Syphilis to begin with, right.
Yeah. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know. I wasn't there. So I left that part out of the book. I said they studied 600 men that had syphilis.
Gotcha. That's a good example, though.
My goal in this is that if you're on my side of the political spectrum, if you look at government with a skeptical eye and you're anything of a student of history, that you'll read this book and maybe you'll learn a thing or two. Maybe you'll go, wait, I didn't realize Project Shad was part of Project 112, or I didn't know that Operation Sea Spray was part of the greater San Francisco biological warfare experiments, or you know, whatever. You'll learn a little something. But I tried to write it in such a way that when you're done reading it, you can hand it to the most progressive, liberal friend, family member, coworker that you have and say, hey, you said something about, you know, universal health care last week. Read part one of this book and then tell me if you still think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And they should be able to read it without getting offended because, again, no conspiracy theories. Everything is provable, documented, admitted facts. And high level enough that it's not a hugely academic read. Like, it's not full of footnotes. It's not going to take you hours and hours to figure it out. You're not going to have to read everything three times to understand it.
Gotcha.
I'm a high school educated, middle class, average guy. And I write for high school educated, middle class, average people.
Right. Now, I want to get into some of that background because it's very interesting to me. When did you, I believe it is the Navy, when did you get into the Navy and what pushed you in that way?
I'm one of those people that always kind of admired military service and expected that I would go in the military. Like,
any family? Sorry to cut you off. Any family with military experience?
No immediate family. Like my dad wasn't in, for example. But if you look back throughout history, I had my father's side of the family came to the United States early 1900s, and we ended up having my great grandfather and his brother Pasquale came here together. And then Pasquale said, "No, I don't like this. I'm going back to Italy." And then ended up fighting in opposite sides of World War One.
Wow.
My grandfather on the other side of my family was in Korea. My father's father, so my paternal grandfather was in World War II. Somewhere in my family, somebody was in just about every war and or conflict from World War One through Desert Storm.
Wow.
With the exception of Vietnam, we didn't have anybody of age at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But
interesting.
I always kind
of did that play an impact, or did you kind of go on your own path?
I kind of went my own path.
I
had an uncle that joined the Navy, but he was kicked out. I think before he even graduated basic training, they found out he had scoliosis. So we didn't have a Navy history. I think everybody else was in the Army. Anyway, I knew I was going to go in the service. I was one of those kids that I always liked to play soldier as a kid. And I got into high school and I didn't know what I was going to do with life. And I refused to spend gazillions of dollars on a college degree and get a degree in a job field that I didn't like and ended up hating and then just had this wasted degree. So I said, I'm going to go in the service. And when it came time to pick which branch of the service, I think it was tradition was the thing that steered me toward the Navy. At that time, they hadn't even changed their uniforms in 200 years. And, you know, they still ring a bell when the captain comes on or off a ship and ring bells for, you know, every hour for the watch. And you know, I just thought it was something, there's something very comforting about tradition.
And did you, when you started to bring that back, so how long were you actually serving in the military for?
I only did 2 years on active duty.
Okay.
And then I went into the reserves. And I was.
When you came back, did you want to stay in that kind of role? Like you said, so you stayed in the reserves. When did you move on to this this constable, that constableship that moves into more localized Pennsylvania for yourself?
Well, the constable thing was kind of a fluke.
Really?
My regular full-time job is I'm a mailman.
Okay.
First, let me tell you what the constable is in Pennsylvania.
Please.
A constable is a strange combination of state law enforcement and mercenary. So it's statewide jurisdiction. It's a sworn peace officer. But you can also work for private individuals. So For example, if you were here and you wanted to serve papers on somebody or you needed to evict somebody from your rental property or whatever, you can hire a constable to do that work. Or the most common thing I get hired to do is with a civil standby.
Okay.
You know, you moved out of your house with your ex-wife. You know, you broke up and you moved out, but you left some stuff behind. And you want to go back and get your stuff.
Right.
But you want it to be peaceful, and you know, so you hire me and I stand there with a gun and a badge, and my job is to just make sure that it stays peaceful.
Understandable. That is unfortunately a very common need in our society at this point.
The one thing that a constable is required to do is to maintain peace at the polling stations on election day. So every town in Pennsylvania has the ability, has the right to elect or appoint a Pennsylvania state constable. So my little town, the last time the municipal elections rolled around, my town didn't elect one. And I went, well, what's a constable? And I did the research to find out what it was. And I thought, wait, they're responsible for peace at the polling stations. Elections are getting pretty ugly. That sounds important. So then I went, what happens when there's a vacancy? And I figured out how to get myself appointed to the job. So I am the Pennsylvania State Constable for my little town for 6 years. And really the only thing I do with that badge, with that job, is maintaining peace at the polling stations. Every once in a while, somebody will call me for civil standby or something like that. And
right.
If it's not too inconvenient, I'll do it. But I have a regular full-time job. So I don't process arrest warrants. I don't do, you know, process serving from the courts or anything like that a constable can do. And those that want to make a living as constable, those are the things that they do.
Now, you mentioned that it was statewide jurisdiction. Does that mean that you guys have some sort of a get-together? Is there any sort of body of constables? How does that work?
There's a couple of unofficial groups, kind of like kind of like, you know, the Fraternal Order of Police. So there's constable associations. Mm-hmm. But we are trained and certified by a state agency. And we can, you know, if there's an arrest warrant for you and you're three counties over, I can either call somebody three counties over to come get you, or I can drive over there myself and get you.
Right. That's pretty interesting. So the constable was a new concept to you when you'd found it, and you found out because it was empty on your voting ballot. As you've witnessed this, you said for 6 years, have you noticed a change in the elections that you're overseeing?
No, not really.
Okay.
I would say maybe a little more attendance.
A little more attendance. Okay.
And surprisingly, apparently previous constables for my town, if either didn't do it or didn't keep the job or whatever, but a lot of people are surprised to see me, at the polling stations here in Pennsylvania. You know, sheriffs and state police and local police, they're not allowed to be at the polling stations. They go in, they vote, they leave. They're not allowed to hang out there. If something happens, I'm expected to call them. I'm there to make sure that nothing happens. And if necessary, I call them. The interesting thing about the constable is the Pennsylvania State Constable, the first documented Pennsylvania State Constable was 1667. So the idea of a constable in Pennsylvania predates the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Now, Peter, is there any sort of training or police academy you have to do to get to, in order to be qualified to be appointed to this?
Well, there is not for the job itself. So to be the constable and do the election day duties, no, there's nothing. Just you have to have the trust of your town. To do the work for the courts, if you're going to start doing process warrants or transport prisoners or any of the other things, those things, yes, there's training that you have to do. It's about, I think it's 8 weeks, eight consecutive weekends of training. And it costs about $3,000. And you have
to. Do you get any sort of reimbursement back on that? Do you get any sort of stipend from the state?
Nope. I get no pay. I get, you know, a pittance on election day. I get paid for that. And then working for the courts, you get paid per job. So I don't remember what the numbers are.
So it would depend on if you were serving a certain amount of warrants or whatnot. So,
you know, maybe you get $50 for an arrest warrant and $20 to process, just to serve a notice to appear type warrant or, you know.
Gotcha. So that's pretty interesting. And you still have the ability, of course, to still do all the things that you mentioned earlier, hire yourself out for private peacekeeping and whatnot.
Yeah. The only thing that
I did notice something that was, sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say the only thing that the training is required for is the working for the court. The court cannot pay you if you don't go through the
certification. Unless you're not like certified. Yeah. Okay. I feel like that's more than fair because anybody could be elected constable.
Yep.
Then, in that case, do you see yourself at some point wanting to attain those other aspects of the job, or do you like keeping it where it's at in its capacity for you at the moment?
No, I don't have any desire to become certified and do that work. I like having a steady, reliable paycheck of a regular job, and constables are kind of at the will of the court. They, you know, 1 week they might have a huge pile of warrants that they have to serve, and the next week there might not be any.
Right. That's not your choosing. I like that a lot. So do you plan on keeping this going though? It seems like you really do value the institution in and of itself.
I do. That is constable. I do value it. But being a mailman, that makes me a federal employee. And as a federal employee, I am not allowed to run for office. So I cannot campaign or be on the ballot next time around to be constable. I can be a
Oh, interesting. So you, what is the term for it?
6 years.
It is 6 years. Okay. So you would basically have to drop it. Nobody would have to run, and then you'd have to reappoint again.
Unless, I mean, there is a possibility if without me campaigning for it, people just knowing my name, write me in. I mean, it's a
small and that wouldn't,
town. It doesn't take a whole lot of write-ins to get a job.
Right. But that wouldn't negatively impact.
No.
You.
I just,
if they did that on their own time.
I can't be on the ballot and I can't campaign.
Got it. Okay. That's pretty interesting. And I assume you enjoy your work with the post office.
No,
I
hate working.
Pretty good job from what I've heard.
I tell people all the time, you tell people, oh, yeah, what do you do for a living? I'm like, oh, I'm a mailman. They're like, oh, that's a good job. I'm like, no, it's a miserable job. That's why it pays so well.
Well, that's why it's a good job. I don't think people are talking about the day-to-day being enjoyable. It's the payday at the end of the day.
I tell people, you know, and I say that, and they'll be like, why would you say that? I'm like, okay, let's talk for a second. I'm going to use round numbers here. Let's pretend that I have 3,000 pieces of mail today, which is that's a pretty light day, actually.
Okay.
And I put an envelope in the wrong mailbox 30 times. That's still a 99.9% success rate. Pretty good, right? 30 different people are going to yell at me tomorrow.
Yeah, I would assume that's not a great success rate.
What job can you have a 99.9% success rate at and get yelled at by 30 different people?
It's an interesting way.
Is it at least pretty local that you know all the, you know, everybody?
Yeah, most people are pretty good. You know, you put it in the box and they'll just give it to their neighbor or they'll put it back in the mailbox and say, you know, this isn't ours. But there are some people that are just weird about their mail and they get really angry if they get the
wrong. Oh, yeah, I know. That's really funny. I wasn't expecting you to be a post office worker at all, to be honest with you.
Surprise.
Given that your writing is going the direction that it is, you see yourself continuing to try to be an author in the future?
Yeah, I'm not sure what I want to do though. I was recently kicking around the idea. All right, so when I first started writing this first book, Progress Really, was me going, man, there's something wrong in the world. And then when I wrote the second book, So Simple Even a Politician Can Understand, I started to think, hey, I'm pretty far on the right side of the political aisle. And it was probably about the time I finished the third book, A More Tyrannical King, that I realize that I'm a constitutional originalist. I believe that the U.S. Constitution is the reason that we were such a successful nation. And I believe that the U.S. Constitution and adherence to it is the only way we're going to continue to be successful. So gotcha. The problem with that is nobody reads it anymore. Mm. 2 million civilian federal employees in this country, all of which have to raise their right hand and swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution. None of them read it.
Right.
There's another 2 million military members who all did that same thing. I was 18 years old and raised my hand and swore that oath. I hadn't read it since grade school.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem that I see is the education of it. There's a quote from John Jay, the author of several of the Federalist Papers and First Chief
Justice. Love John Jay's papers.
First Chief Justice of the United States. He said, and I don't do well with quotes, so it might be right, it might not be right, but the gist will be right. It is the duty of every citizen, or the duty of the citizen of any state, to read and study the Constitution of his country,
mm-hmm.
to know his right, so he will better perceive when his rights are violated. It is the duty to read and study the Constitution, teach the rising generation to be free, and he will be better prepared to know when his rights are violated. The problem that we have today is we don't read and study the Constitution anymore. We're fat and lazy. We've been too comfortable for too long, too much freedom for too long.
Mm.
We stopped paying attention to the Constitution, and our government took advantage of that and ran away.
I think that a big thing, too, is misunderstanding, at least in my opinion, and I would say we fall on very similar sides of the aisle. At least I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a constitutional originalist per se, but I'm damn close. And if anything, that's where I would want to be. And when you look at it, the definition of freedom, I think, has changed in the sense that in the time of when our Constitution was written, the freedom was freedom from tyranny and freedom from somebody oppressing you. And today it's turned into a freedom to do whatever the hell you want. And that even includes trashing all institutions that brought us to where we are today.
Oh, right.
So I think freedom in of itself has changed, at least in the minds of Americans.
Yes, our perception of it has, yes.
Right.
You now think that you're not free if somebody has the power to hurt your feelings.
Hate speech is a great example.
You know what?
It really doesn't exist.
Hate speech is perfectly legal. According to the U.S. Constitution.
It really shouldn't exist as a term. Right. Not in America anyway. I understand it in other places, but in America it doesn't have a place. There's so many examples that you could point to. I mean, what is it, the Fourth Amendment that is basically no longer adhered to?
They find so many ways around the Fourth Amendment. It's disgusting.
Yeah. So
just the simple grammar, like people stop and read the Constitution. Here's one of my favorite examples. Okay, so we all, the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court has decided that there's this incorporation doctrine, that the wording of the 14th Amendment somehow makes all of the other rights within the Constitution apply at the state and local level as well. That was never the intent of our Constitution. It was never in the intent of the authors of the 14th Amendment. You can go back and find the writings of the people that put forth the 14th Amendment and said, this amendment grants no extra power to the federal government. But the Supreme Court, or as I like to call them, nine tyrants in black robes, the Supreme Court has decided that, no, this language means that all of the Constitution applies to state and local governments as well. To prove that that was not the intent of our founding fathers, the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, establishing a religion, blah, 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 blah. Congress shall make no law.
Right.
But in 1791, when the First Amendment was ratified, three of the 13 states had state religions. Well, that would be a violation of the Establishment Clause. Most of the states and colonies, or the states and towns, had blasphemy laws and profanity laws. Well, that would be violations of free speech, wouldn't it? Because what was the language of the First Amendment? Congress shall make no law. Right. So the federal government can't do those things, but the state and local governments can. Originally. Now contrast that to the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It doesn't say shall not be infringed by Congress. It says shall not be infringed, period.
Right.
So the language
shouldn't matter state, shouldn't matter federally. Right.
Congress can't make laws about speech or religion. Nobody can make laws about guns. That was the original
simple language. Wording that you're pointing out is a perfect example of why we should be reading this document more regularly.
Exactly.
And because it's clear.
It is 4,500-ish words. If you sit down and read it.
I was going to say.
20 minutes. 30
you
minutes.
Could read it in a sitting.
Yeah.
You could read it in a sitting.
Yeah. 30 minutes if you stumble over the old-fashioned language. But it's also, remember, half of the men who were there and drafted the Constitution and signed it in the end were attorneys.
Right.
But they wrote the Constitution so that the 18th century farmer could understand it. It's not written in attorney's legalese. It's written in plain language that anybody can understand.
Correct.
On purpose. Because we're all supposed to read it and study it.
Right.
And keep our government in check because we know what it says.
Right. I think that I couldn't agree with you more that this is the path that we're heading to. And I know your writing seems to follow this path as well. But do you have solution sets in mind as well? As you're writing these books, do you come to any sort of an understanding on how some of these problems that we're dealing with today, you know, take, for example, an issue that was brought up a little bit earlier with the amount of people that are separating from their partners. Like, is there a solution by way of going back to constitutional originalism or some form of it that we start to get back to less divorces, more together families, less broken families and whatnot?
Well, that's
just one example.
Right.
But
it's a very important example.
Yeah, I agree.
But it also, it brushes upon religion. And a lot of people don't want to talk about that.
It does. It does.
But our founders did.
Right.
Go all the way back to the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson sits down. They're like, hey, you're going to write this thing. He's like, all right. So he sits down. He writes out the first draft of the Declaration of Independence. And then he gives it to the committee, the drafting committee. Mm-hmm. Committee of Three. They say, wait a minute. You only put one reference to God in this. You should put at least one more. Back to the drawing board. So he writes it again. And he puts a second reference to God in it. And the committee goes, okay, let's present it to Congress now. They take it to Congress. Congress puts two more references to God in the Declaration of Independence before they approve it. So the idea of separation of church and state, that phrase came from a letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Church. The wall of separation, that phrase came out of that letter. Nobody had ever used that term before from that letter. But if you read the entire context of the letter, Jefferson was telling the church not to worry about the government getting involved into their affairs. There's no reference to keeping the church out of government.
Right.
Every session of Congress starts with a prayer. Still does. Every session of the Supreme Court starts with a prayer. Every president since George Washington has added the words under God to their oath. It's not there, but they have all added it. Back to the Supreme Court. Big, giant, beautiful doors that go into the Supreme Court. You know what's on the back of those doors? The Ten Commandments. Church and God were never supposed to be taken out of government. Government was supposed to stay out of church. It's not a two-way street.
That's interesting. And it's also impossible, right? Because I think that's another great point as well, because in my opinion, we've become a very secularly ruled society, and not just in America. I think this is broadly stroked across the world. We are very secular. It is impossible to have religion not be a part of your way of thinking as a human being. So if you're not going to explicitly allow religion to be in your government, then the government is going to form its own religion in of itself. And that is what I think we're witnessing.
I would agree to some extent. A lot of people take on a cause, and that cause becomes their religion.
Right. So that's where I'm getting at. Yep.
Yeah. Whether that cause is climate change, or whether that clause is, you know, trans rights, or whatever.
Or it's prison reform, right?
Yep. Right. Whatever their cause is becomes their religion. I'm not a terrible
religious man. Exactly. I think you're watching that.
I never have been. But since I've started studying the Constitution and our founders, I'm becoming more religious. I have more faith now. Which is probably backwards of how that should work, but it's working, you know.
My guess is that the founders, as much as they might not have been able to predict to the letter what we're dealing with today, they had a lot of foresights into seeing how even as great of a base that they set up for us could crumble. I'm sure that they foresaw many ways, and even as they started instituting their original constitution, seeing its flaws and working on, you know, through the Federalist Papers and seeing how they started changing their original thoughts on government. You know, they expected things to go downhill at certain points. That was kind of the whole point of this form of government.
Well, right. Prior to the United States, constitutional republics didn't last. And they had to be small to have any staying power. Ours is huge. And it's now twice the life expectancy of a constitutional republic. Right. And our founders knew that. Our founders knew that from day one. I mean, the famous quote from Ben Franklin, when asked after the Second Congress, when he came out, he said, you know, what kind of government have you given us? He said, a republic, madam, if we can keep it. Mm-hmm. From day one, they knew it was treacherous grounds. The Federalist Papers, right, before the Constitution is ratified, the Federalist Papers repeatedly talk about we're men. You know, If men were governed by angels, no government would be necessary. If men were angels, no government. But anyway, but they know men are flawed.
Right.
And they all talk about it's up to us, the citizens.
People.
We have to keep a watchful eye. And we haven't done that. I would say that the government did pretty good. Pretty good. Not perfect, of course. For the first 100 years, the Civil War was in there, and that was bad. But then the next
or good years,
I always point to 1913 as the beginning of the ski slope downhill.
Okay,
like up till
1913. What's any exact event?
Three of them.
Okay,
1913, the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, and the creation of the Federal Reserve. Those three things all happened in 1913, and those three things completely flipped the power structure in our country. Do you think, did we have
income tax, popular election of senators, and the Federal Reserve?
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
So the 16th Amendment is income tax. Income tax is supposed to fund our government, right? Well, the government, according to the Constitution, has 17 jobs. Did they do all 17 of those things before the income tax? Yep.
Right.
I mean, did we have roads and hospitals and schools before 1913? Yep. The 17th Amendment, the changing of how the popular election of senators. Okay, so prior to 1913, state legislatures appointed the two senators.
They voted on the senators, right?
Why would they do that? Why did our framers set it up so that the state government appointed senators and not we the people?
Well, you're going to have one deviation removed from pure democracy.
Right.
Right.
Right. the way the Constitution was written, the original setup, the only person that you and I voted on was our Congress, the House of Representatives.
Right.
Everything about, there's three
elected Wouldn't the houses. Senate appoint the president as well? Or is that a mistake?
No. The Electoral College elects the president. You and I.
And that's been consistent.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been consistent. The changes have, in that regard, have all come from the state level. The state has the power to decide how to appoint those electors. Every state has gone out and decided to allow us to vote on those electors. But that's not a requirement. Right. Your state tomorrow could decide, you know what,
that right.
this popular vote for the president thing, it's really unnecessary. And just say, you don't vote for president anymore. And it would be perfectly legal.
Right.
Or constitutional, I should say. So House of Representatives, elected the most frequent every 2 years, directly elected by the people in their district. The Senate, 6 to 6 year terms, elected by the state. And then the presidency, 4 years, elected by this other group, the Electoral College. Three different federal elected jobs, three different terms of service, three different method of elections. That was all done on purpose.
Right.
And now that a senator is elected by the people of their state, they're really no different than a glorified member of the House of Representatives. They are.
Exactly.
They are.
Senior member.
Yeah, the senior member.
That's what I like to say.
They're subject to the whims of the masses.
Yes.
When they were elected by the state legislators, you know, they had 200 people that they reported to. Now they report to millions. Mm. And when the state legislators appointed senators, the state had a voice in Washington, D.C. to make sure that the federal government didn't trample on states' rights.
Right.
Where's that Lost voice that now? Right. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the 16th was income tax, 17th was the popular election of senators, and then the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Our money is worthless, and everybody knows it.
Yeah.
And the Federal Reserve isn't federal. They have a federal name, but they're not a government agency. They're a private bank.
Yep.
But they control our money. You know, I don't have my wallet on me, but whip out a note. What's it say? Federal Reserve note.
Yep.
What's that mean? Well, what that means is you put $100 in a safe and leave it there for a year and come back a year later, you'll still have $100, right? But will it buy as much stuff?
Never.
No, it won't. Back when we had money that was money, gold, silver, or paper notes that represented gold and silver.
Right.
There was no inflation. Inflation is completely man-made by the government printing too much money. And who does that?
Right.
The Federal Reserve. So yeah.
You're not the first person I've heard that from, but the Federal Reserve is one of the biggest, it's one of the biggest issues in my head of, like you said, it's a turning point. It is an absolute change in our direction as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it directly points as well to the wars, the subsequent wars that we would get into over the next century as well. Century up to today, honestly. The stuff that we continue to do, the stuff with Ukraine, the stuff with Israel is only possible with the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
If we were on the gold standard, it is impossible to be funding anything like these operations.
Right. Because with the gold standard, you can only print as much money as you have gold.
As you had gold.
Because if everybody in the country took their little paper note that said, hey, this is worth an ounce of gold.
And they wanted to redeem it.
And they wanted
you better be able to put it up there.
Mm-hmm. So the income tax, I kind of want to go back to that for a second, because income tax completely flipped the power structure in our country because it flipped the flow of money.
Mm.
Prior to 1913 and the 16th Amendment and the income tax, which, by the way, income tax was found unconstitutional and struck down twice before the 16th Amendment.
Very interesting.
Before the 16th Amendment, when the federal government needed money, they sent a bill to the states. And the bill was apportioned by the population of the state. So
it was directly, so you basically knew exactly why you had to pay more taxes this year. It is because our federal government is asking to be funded.
Well, not only that, but then your state had the power and the decision to make of how to raise that money, which is why you have some states that have a sales tax and some that don't, some that have income tax and some that don't, some that have, you know, high tourist type taxes and some that don't, and some where, you know, the federal government gave them the bill and they're like, eh, we're rich, just write them a check, we'll worry about it later. So the federal government had to ask the states for money. It was unconstitutional for the federal government to directly tax you and I, the citizens. 16th Amendment comes around and gives them the power to do that. So now they're bypassing the state, taking the money from you and I, putting it through the IRS, the massive federal bureaucracy, and then a large portion of that money is divvied back out to the state and local governments as bribes, or I'm sorry, grants. Why did they take it in the first place? If your town needs more money for, you know, upgrading the water system or something, why can't they just get that from you themselves? Why does it have to go through this massive bureaucracy and then be used as a carrot or a, you know, stick, one or the other?
I like that, though. I didn't realize that all those were instituted. I'll have to go back and check, but all instituted in 1913.
Oh, yeah.
It does make me think that there was plans involved. Do you know how early the income tax was actually introduced when it did get struck down?
The first time it was struck down, I believe, was the Civil War.
Okay.
So 1860s. It might not have gotten struck down until after the war, 1870s. Also interesting to look up. Look, if you're going to dig into Supreme Court history,
yeah,
dig into the two Supreme Court cases that are about 7 months apart about greenback currency, paper notes, paper money. Abraham Lincoln unconstitutionally printed a whole bunch of money with greenbacks to help fund the Civil War. But he did it with a greenback so that after the war, he could pull them back out of the circulation. So he printed more money than he had gold for, but he had a plan of how to get it back out of circulation so it wouldn't ruin the economy later. There was a law passed by Congress that said you had to take this paper money as currency. You couldn't demand payment in gold or silver. You had to accept this legal tender note from the federal government.
The first time
it went to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said, Congress can't do that. If you as a private business want to say, pay me in gold, you have that, absolutely have that right. 7 months later, it went back to the Supreme Court, different case, same situation. Supreme Court reversed it and said, nope, legal tender is a right. Congress can do that. They can force you to take this worthless piece of paper as money.
Gotta wonder what changed in that 7 months, huh?
That'll spark conspiracy theories in your head if you start trying to think about that.
Interesting. There's no chance that that was at any time when they were adding justices. So that's interesting. I'm going to have to go give that a little bit of research. Peter, you give me quite a bit to think on. Andrew, do you have anything else that you wanted to ask? Because, I mean, Peter, I'm going to have to ask you to come back on later, especially after the book is released.
Okay.
Just because the conversation is fascinating. I do want to take a dive into your book and probably ask you some questions reflecting on that. Other than that, like I said, Andrew, anything else you got?
No, I mean, this was great. I mean, you're a very interesting individual. You taught me a lot, and I'm really looking forward to digging into your book and hopefully talking to you again soon. I mean,
happy to come back.
Great.
Hey, well, I got a special deal going on right now since the book isn't even like really for sale yet.
Mm-hmm.
If you pre-order it at my website, the only place you can pre-order it, which is trustshatter.com. It's the only place you can pre-order a physical copy. You can pre-order the ebook on Amazon and for your Nook and all that kind of stuff. But the only place you can pre-order a physical copy is at my website, trustshattered.com. If you pre-order a physical copy there, I will send you an indexed version of the U.S. Constitution. I've got,
that's great.
Love it.
I think I got like 10 of these left. But you go to the back and you say, all right, let's see here. If it shall be the judges of elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members, that's Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1. So whenever you think of a phrase or a power or something, you can look it up in the back, and it tells you exactly where to look in the Constitution to find it. It's a very handy little tool.
Very cool.
That's awesome. So where can they find that, Peter?
Trustshattered.com. I like I said, I think I have 10 left. So the next 10 people that pre-order the book, either paperback or hardcover, I'll send the indexed Constitution with it.
That's awesome. And where can everybody find the rest of your work and stuff about you?
No, well, my homepage is liberty-lighthouse.com. Liberty Lighthouse is kind of my brand. That's the publisher of all the books now. It was my old radio show when I had one. It's the name of my weekly Substack articles now, Liberty Lighthouse. So liberty-lighthouse.com is my homepage. You can find all of my books, links to my Substack, my own bio, my Liberty Lighthouse classroom, which is one of the things I'm really hoping to dive into further once I finish promoting this book. It is online courses on the Constitution.
Well, Peter, thank you again. I just can't explain how thankful I am. This is an awesome show. I learned a lot as well, but I mean, just eye-opening talk and being able to talk with another person who I think is trying to survey the scene and is seeing the spade as a spade right now and not trying to call it a duck.
Yeah, it's
complicated. Have a good one, Peter.
Hey.
Common sense.
That's what I call Liberty Lighthouse, a beacon of common sense, cutting the fog of politics.
There you go. Nailed it.
So, yeah, thanks for having me on. Happy to come back after the book launches. I'll get you copies.
Awesome.
I'll send you electronic copies here soon. So that
awesome. Thank you so much.
Damn. Really looking forward to it.
I
wish I were the fucking
state. I want to be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running. Running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'ma keep dreaming.